Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Today, intelligence officials are poring over a new internet voice recording purportedly made by Osama bin Laden. The voice on the tape claims that Zakarias Moussaoui, the only person convicted in the U.S. for taking part in the September 11th attacks, was not involved in those attacks, and that all of the detainees, except for two at Guantanamo Bay Prison, had no role in 9/11 and aren't even affiliated with al-Qaeda. At least one counterterrorism official in Washington says there's no reason to doubt the authenticity of the tape. Jerry Marcon is covering the story for The Washington Post. And so, Jerry, if it is him, what's the thinking on why bin Laden made the recording now?
The thinking seems to be that it's for the same reason that bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders have uttered various pronouncements in the last couple of months, which is to stay relevant, to demonstrate that they're both knowledgeable about current events and that they have some relevance in the world of terrorism. Because, of course, the five-year anniversary of 9/11 is coming up, and there's certainly been a lot of attacks around the world. In fact, there's been more attacks around the world, but there has not been a major attack, any attack really, in the United States. So bin Laden is just trying to let people know that even though he might be hiding in a cave, he's able to access the media and he's out there.
Well, bin Laden also says in the tape, and again, authorities believe it is bin Laden, he says that Zakarias al-Moussaoui couldn't have been involved in the September 11th attacks, first of all, because he couldn't fly yet. What else does he say to give an explanation as to why he believes Moussaoui had nothing to do with it?
Well, the most basic element is he says, I know because I'm the boss. I know because I personally, you know, assigned the 19 actual hijackers to this mission, and I didn't assign Moussaoui. The other thing he says is he claims that if Moussaoui had been part of 9/11, when Moussaoui was, of course, arrested a month earlier in Minnesota and sat in jail for a month, and he claims that if Moussaoui had been one of the actual hijackers, that would have inspired al-Qaeda to call off the mission. The problem is, it's hard to believe that because there's no evidence that's emerged that anybody even really knew Moussaoui had been arrested. I mean, there was testimony at the trial to that effect that there was no evidence that he tried to contact al-Qaeda. So I'm not sure if that argument holds water.
Right. And it definitely would impact Osama bin Laden's future, given that there's now a recording of him, you know, claiming to be the boss in the events of 9/11.
Right.
Would it at all, though, impact Moussaoui's future?
No. In fact, this was pointed out to me by some federal officials I talked to yesterday. They were sort of puzzled that this came out now, because obviously a jury's not supposed to be reading the newspaper, but you never know what happens. And, you know, their thinking was if bin Laden wanted to have any impact on Moussaoui's fate, he might have done this, you know, a bit earlier. Although the experts we talked to said it clearly was done in recent weeks, so it could have been done before the end of the trial, although we don't know that. The trial ended several weeks ago.
Bin Laden also made comments about the detainees at Guantanamo, saying that only two of them had any kind of links to 9/11. What are authorities making of that statement?
They're sort of putting it in the same light, I think, as the statement with Moussaoui. They're sort of analyzing the whole thing together. And in fact, Guantanamo may be just as much or even more so of an example of trying to stay in the news and relevant than Moussaoui, because as your listeners probably know, the prison continues to be very controversial, and, you know, people around the world, even in the last week or two, have called for it to be closed. But I think the more important thing to point out about what he said about Guantanamo is not these two, but is the fact that he says that just about everybody else there not only is not connected to 9/11, but according to bin Laden, has no connection to al-Qaeda itself.
How would he know that? We don't even know who's in Guantanamo. How would he know that?
Right. Well, that's a good point. So, some of the names have been coming out recently due to court filings, so he may know some of them. You know, al-Qaeda reads the newspaper like everybody else and reads the Internet, obviously. They're very Internet savvy, so he could be reacting to the names, the limited number of names that are known.
Is there anything in these tapes that would actually provide authorities with any information about finding Osama bin Laden?
I think it's fair to say that they scrutinize them relentlessly for just that purpose. They look at what he appears like on the tape, if there's any sign that can be gathered from what's in the background about his location, anything about his voice. I think it's also fair to say, though, that bin Laden has issued a number of tapes since 9/11, including a couple this year, and they haven't found him yet.
Jerry Marcon is with The Washington Post. He's been talking to us about a new internet voice recording purportedly made by Osama bin Laden. Jerry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to spend a few minutes on a political check-in as midterm election campaigns rev up along with the Memorial Day weekend barbecues. After months of negotiations, U.S. senators cleared the way today for a vote tomorrow on their plan to provide a path to citizenship for immigrants. That's sure to provide lawmakers with a lot to talk to voters about over the Memorial Day weekend, which is the traditional kickoff for midterm campaigns. But this year, with the House and Senate narrowly divided and all eyes on the White House in 2008, a handful of vulnerable politicians have been campaigning for months on issues such as immigration reform and also corruption. On that topic, the news wasn't good for Democrats this week when Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson was accused of taking a briefcase full of bribe money and hiding some of the foil-wrapped cash in his freezer. Republicans are hoping that charge will shift the spotlight from indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Abramoff has pled guilty to conspiracy to bribe public officials. His shadow hangs over many nervous Republicans. And his opening statements are being heard today in the corruption trial of former White House aide David Safavian, who is accused of improper dealings with Jack Abramoff. In a moment, we'll look at how all of this is playing out nationwide. But first, a closer look at how it's playing out in one state. That's the re-election race of Montana Republican Senator Conrad Burns. Now, Democrats need only 6 seats to gain control of the Senate. They're eyeing Burns as one of the most vulnerable Republican incumbents because he received more campaign money than any other member of Congress from Jack Abramoff. Joining us on the line from Helena, Montana, is reporter Mike Denniston, who writes for the Lee Newspaper's State Bureau. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
And Conrad Burns, third-term Republican in a Republican-leading state, one of President Bush's strongest supporters. Some would say re-election should be a shoo-in. So what's the problem?
Well, in Montana, even though it's called Republican-leaning, it's been traditionally kind of a split state between Republicans and Democrats. In fact, when Burns ran 6 years ago, he barely won with 51% of the vote. And the person who ran against him is now the governor of the state, who's going to campaign very hard against him. So I never thought it was a shoo-in from the beginning. And then we throw in the factor of Abramoff and the fact that Bush is very unpopular and that Burns is one of his strongest supporters. I think Burns knows right off the bat that he's going to have a tough race.
Well, you quote someone in one of your articles saying that this may be the race that decides party control of the U.S. Senate. Do you think it's that important? Are they viewing it that way there?
Well, that was a quote from Burns' own campaign people. So I think they're certainly thinking that, and I think it could be that. I think they're thinking that earlier in the day, on Election Day, there could be some losses by Republicans, so it comes down to the West, and this could be the race that decides it. They're looking at that and telling their supporters that because they think a lot of money is going to be coming in from outside sources on the Democratic side against Burns, you know, 527 groups, et cetera, to try to spend and win this race.
Well, but it's coming in from the Republican side as well.
As well, right now, Burns is raising a lot of money. He's already raised more than $6 million, which in Montana at this point is an incredible amount of money. He's going to break all records for the amount that is just his campaign itself has raised. It's probably going to be close to $10 million. This is very similar to the race 2 years ago in South Dakota, where we had Senator Daschle attracting all his national attention in a small rural state.
Well, how is he handling the charges of his ties with Jack Abramoff?
Well, he did run an ad earlier this year trying to rebut it. But when he's on the campaign trail, though, I was out with him for a day-long trip, and you know the subject never really came up with the people he was talking about. The constituents he was talking with.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said is that, you know, I never knew Abramoff. I maybe talked to him once. This is handled by my staff. He's also kind of distanced himself from staff who may be in potential legal trouble, saying, I told the staff what the ethics were. What they do is their decision. And so that's kind of how he's playing. He's also hired an attorney as well.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that this race, and we're going to ask another analyst in just a moment, but do you think that his handling that kind of reflects how other campaigns might handle corruption charges? Or, you know, is he doing it in his own unique way because he's a unique individual?
I really don't know because I haven't seen how other people are handling it. But I think it kind of surprised us that he came right out and said, with an ad talking about Abramoff to the people, rather than just trying to kind of ignore it. So he's kind of addressed it head on, and I think he's done that because he feels that he has to do that.
In fact, we have heard that incumbents across the country, Republicans in particular, are coming out swinging. They're sort of, that seems to be sort of the message that's been sent out. And, you know, we recently heard that Karl Rove was charged with overseeing the national midterm elections. Do you see his hand in the campaign in Montana? Do you see sort of a Republican Party imprint on it?
I think so. I think that Burns is kind of following the the script that you come out early, you start trying to paint the Democrats in a certain way and saying, these guys are for tax increases, these guys don't have a plan. In other words, trying to define your opponent before he gets a chance to define himself.
Yeah. Well, there have been rumors, though, that Burns might consider withdrawing. Do you think that's likely?
Not at all. Those are rumors a lot earlier in the year. He has always said, no way am I withdrawing.
Actually, you quoted him as saying, there's no reverse in my transmission.
Exactly, yes.
I like that line. Well, President Bush, fundraising for Conrad Burns in Washington in March, made a joke at Burns' expense. Bush said he liked being on the same stage as Conrad Burns because he makes me sound like Shakespeare. Conrad Burns seems to be kind of a folksy guy.
Yeah, that's kind of a stick that he plays a lot, kind of being this rural guy. He has a lot of connections to agriculture. He came out of ag. He was an auctioneer at livestock yards and owned radio stations that had farm news, and that was their emphasis. And so he plays it up quite a bit. I think Mr. Burns is probably more sophisticated than he likes to portray and his public persona, though.
Yeah. Well, Conrad Burns, again, going for his fourth try. He's a third-term Republican in the state of Montana. And we're speaking to Mike Dennison, reporter for the Lee Newspaper State Bureau in Helena, Montana. And, Mike, just a second there. I want to bring in Julian Zelitzer, who's a congressional historian and politics watcher at Boston University here in Boston, because I know, Julian, you had a question for Mike.
Well, I was curious if his polls had been swinging at all, Conrad Burns, or have they been steady? For a while we were hearing he was over the scandal and that it looked like his polls had leveled. Is that still true?
Well, the polls that we've seen, and we've not really seen any what I would call independent polls, but most of the polls that I've seen or heard of show Burns trailing or even with his potential Democratic opponents. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's changed much in the last several months.
We're going to be talking to Julian much more about how races like this one sort of are resonating across the country. But in the meantime, Mike, we know Conrad Burns still has a Republican primary to get passed in a couple of weeks. Then he'll, if he wins, face a Democrat. The criticism nationwide of the Democrats is that they don't have a plan. Is that what is being lobbed in Montana as well?
Yes, that's what Burns' ads have said. He's had radio ads, a series of them, and he's almost said that in every single ad, which I think is probably incorrect. I mean, the Democrats have plans. They've been coming out with them and outlining them, but the problem is that people out there really aren't paying attention and don't really know that, so they hear these ads and they have no plan, which sounds very credible because they don't know of the plan that they have.
All right. Mike Dennison, again, a reporter in Helena, Montana, covering the campaign of Conrad Burns, one of the considered, vulnerable seats as we run up to the midterm elections. And just, again, we talked about how he's, kind of a likable guy in the state. You traveled with him everywhere he went. People knew him. How much of a shocker would it be if he didn't win?
I don't think it would be a big shock because, like I said, 6 years ago he won with 51% of the vote, and actually he was going into that race the last day or two thinking he was going to lose. Mm. So I think he's thinking that it's going to be a tough race.
Mike, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, that's just one look at one race. How much does it reflect what's happening across the country as we head into the Memorial Day weekend, the traditional startup of the midterm elections? We'll find out. We'll come back with Julian Zelitzer, take a look nationwide. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. On the upcoming midterm elections and how issues such as corruption, immigration are going to be playing out in the campaigns. We're joined in the studio by Julian Zelitzer, a congressional historian and politics watcher at Boston University. And Julian, you said I can call you Julian and not professor, which I'm going to do.
Absolutely.
First of all, your thoughts. We just heard about the Conrad Burns Senate race in Montana, people saying that could be the race that decides who controls the U.S. Senate. Your thoughts?
Well, given we're talking about a few seats can change the Senate, any race at this point can change who controls the Senate. So I don't think it's Burns in particular. I think it's the narrowness of the Senate. But he is an important litmus test. He is a litmus test of how this corruption scandal is going to actually affect voter decisions. Right. And I think that's what people are looking for.
And by the way, remind us of the seats. 6 in the Senate?
Yes.
And in the 15 House?
15
in the House. So the corruption. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is resigning next month to face other corruption charges. So far, no lawmaker has been formally charged in the Jack Abramoff case. But as we said, there's a shadow over Conrad Burns because of how much money he received from lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And today, David Safavian, the Republican operative who held several jobs in the government, is charged with lying about his contacts with Jack Abramoff and his David Savavian's trip on a private jet with Abramoff to go golfing in Scotland in 2002. That's what that's all about, and that's resonating today. It's one thing for corruption charges to affect a race when the incumbent is sort of directly tied to it. But do you think Americans will really care about these other corruption charges against people such as David Safavian that they don't know?
I think each individual case won't have a huge effect. I think it's the cumulative effect of all these charges coming about. People don't like politicians to begin with in America. And when you have a series of stories about corruption, about sordid lobbying deals, I think it creates an atmosphere where incumbents can be knocked down. And that's what's already happened. All of a sudden, we're talking about the possibility of a turnover in Congress, which was impossible a year ago. And that's how this, I think, these charges have affected the race.
Well, there's other issues as well. We're going to bring them up. But, you know, then we also saw that Congressman Jefferson, a Democrat, being charged with squirreling money away in his freezer. Republicans, of course, are saying that that punches a hole in the Democrats' plan to pin corruption on them. Do you think it does?
No, I don't think so. Historically, when voters lash out against corruption, they take out the party in power, and they don't care about who exactly is in the mix. When the House banking scandal broke in 1991 and 92, there were many Republicans involved, but voters took it out against Democrats. And I think the same would happen. Any story about corruption now does not benefit the Republicans, even if it's a Democrat.
And some would say, you know, do the math. There's more on their side than our side. I mean, but you're saying it doesn't even matter. It's who's in power. Well, and in fact, there was a huge kerfuffle in Congress over the fact that the FBI raided Congressman William Jefferson's office to get their alleged evidence. That was on Saturday night. And today, House Speaker Dennis Hastert is demanding that the documents the FBI took be returned. So there seems to be this rare bipartisan outrage over that raid.
Right. There's finally bipartisanship on Capitol Hill, and it's about defending themselves. I think, you know, part of it is a frustration in Congress and both parties that the president has been so dominant in the past few years. And I think this reflects tensions about other issues. But also, I think Congress is a little scared. I mean, they're under investigation. The Justice Department has been highly aggressive in the last few years against Republicans and Democrats. And I think they're starting to react. I think they're nervous not about this Jefferson raid, but what else might the Justice Department do if this is allowed?
What else do people have in their freezers?
Exactly.
Well, let's move on to immigration. Conservative Fred Barnes, writing in the Weekly Standard, says that President Bush and the Republicans are staring political disaster in the face if they don't pass a reform bill, because so many people have opinions on the subject as opposed to others, where you may be only focusing on one segment of the population. What do you think has got to happen for the Republicans, and what do you think will happen?
I don't know what will happen. I think in general they need to pass something. I think President Bush has staked a lot on immigration and being kind or open to immigrants, and if he fails on this, it's a huge failure. And this has become the major big-ticket item of the year. And if President Bush, who has openly supported this kind of reform, can't get it through because of his own party, it doesn't look good for him, and it doesn't bode well for the next few years.
How is it? Do you already see it playing out in campaigns? I mean, how do you see it affecting people?
Sure, but within the Republican Party, you have a pretty stark division. You have some in the South and Southwest who are pretty hardline anti-immigrants who are running against the president and against the president's openness, and you have many other key figures who are looking to 2008, not just 2006, saying we need this immigrant vote and we need to pass this measure. So it's splitting the Republican Party in this election.
Well, we should note that Presidential Advisor Karl Rove, meeting for the second time in 2 weeks with House Republicans on the topic of immigration, asked whether he made any progress on a House-Senate compromise, because, again, the House bill is much tougher on immigrants, calling for the wall and everything, than the Senate bill is. Rove said to reporters afterwards, it could be that I've forged a compromise here. So we'll see on that. What if Democrats don't gain control over Congress, given all of the problems that the Republicans are facing? What does that say about the Democratic Party?
Well, it might just say incumbents are very powerful in this day and age, and most House seats are gerrymandered to protect incumbents. And it might just say that. It might not be about Democrats, but about how our elections are run. But clearly, if they come about without any big victory, there'll be some soul searching. And thinking about 2008, why didn't they resonate with voters in this horrible moment for Republicans? And Democrats need a very clear, crisp message for 2008 if that happens.
You say soul searching. Some might say disgust, you know, given it, you know, the climate. And given that, you know, we see people sort of constantly resurfacing. Al Gore, and we just have about a minute here, but Al Gore is back on the scene with his new movie on global warming, An Inconvenient Truth. It opens today. He said on the Today Show this morning he has no further political ambitions. Do you believe it?
I never believe a politician when they say that, especially a young, relatively young politician who's in the media all the time. And I'm sure he's still hungry for some kind of maybe presidential victory.
We'll see. Julian Zelitzer, congressional historian at Boston University. And by the way, a Guggenheim Fellow this year. Thanks so much, as always, for stopping by.
Thank you.
And by the way, this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, the Commerce Department says the sale of new homes rose unexpectedly last month. The key word there, though, new. The news isn't so positive for homeowners looking to sell old homes. Tomorrow, a look at the housing market. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Tourists travel to Greenland for the thrill of watching giant icebergs float down fast-moving fjords. But there are concerns about how long that show will last. A recent NASA study reveals that the loss of ice in Greenland has doubled from 1996 to 2005, and that has scientists worried about the impacts of global warming. Freelance journalist Dan Grossman is in Greenland now. He recently visited the fast-moving Jakobshavn Glacier there. We caught up with him yesterday via satellite phone and started by asking him where he was.
I'm actually on the ice sheet. I'm at a research camp on the ice sheet just inland from Jakobshavn Glacier.
Dan, just a quick definition. What is an ice sheet and what really is a glacier?
Well, an ice sheet is just a very, very big glacier. There's the two biggest ice sheets are the Antarctic ice sheet, which covers most of Antarctica, and the second largest is the Greenland ice sheet, which covers about 80% or so of Greenland. It's just a huge block of ice that covers this entire island, which is about a fifth the size of the continental United States.
Well, so we know the Jakobshavn Glacier is considered one of the fastest moving in Greenland. First of all, what does that mean? I mean, does it literally flow by you?
Well, it's moving at about 4 feet an hour. You know, if you stood there long enough, you probably could see that. If you put a flag on it, if you could stand on it, which you can't, because it's very dangerous, because it's got humongous blocks of ice that are shifting around. What you can see when you're looking at it from the ocean, which I did just a couple of days ago, is you can see these blocks or big chunks of ice just breaking off. It's called calving, and they break off with a gigantic cannon sound, and you can see these big pieces break off and fall off into the ocean.
Well, actually, I know you have some sound of that calving of an iceberg. Can you play that for us?
Sure, yes. I chartered a boat so that I could I couldn't get to Jakobshavn, but I went to a nearby glacier, and here, let me play you some of the sound.
Dan, what's happening when you see these icebergs, you know, just snap off? What are you seeing?
Well, what you see is a piece of ice anywhere from the size of a microwave oven to the size of a car just kind of break off and just slides down the face. And so first you hear this crack, which is it breaking off, and then you hear this rushing sound as it slides down the face and crashes into the ocean. And then there's a big wave. If it's a big piece, a big wave gets formed, which then flows away from the base of the glacier. And in the case of the one that I played you, it rocked a nearby iceberg, which then broke into pieces.
And what's the significance of this? I would imagine, icebergs have been doing this for a long time. What's the significance now?
Well, the significance is that global warming may be having an impact on these outlet glaciers, and they'll speed up even more. And this could be a way that the ice sheet would shrink. It's not like global warming is melting the surface and causing water to evaporate. It's that somehow or other the warming is causing the glacier to speed up, and the frozen water is basically being ejected. So it's a different way than we commonly think a piece of ice could shrink.
And so faster speeding icebergs heading towards the ocean would have the impact of displacing more water from the ocean.
That's right. That's right. If all of the Greenland ice sheet were to melt, that would cause a rise of sea level of about 7 feet. That's a huge amount of sea level increase. Now, nobody's saying that that's about to happen anytime soon, but there are a number of researchers I've talked to who are saying this is shrinking faster than they anticipated it could shrink. And the significance for people outside of Greenland is that the sea level will increase. Of course, inside of Greenland, it makes a big difference for the people who live here.
And how so would it for them?
The warming is already impacting the people who live in Greenland. I've been told that by the researchers here that the town where I left from to fly up to here is called Ilulissat, and it's a town that has several thousand Danes and Inuit people, and they get around during the winter in their snowmobiles on sea ice, which is frozen seawater off the coast of their town. And the last 2 years, there was no sea ice. They couldn't get around. And apparently there's even some discussion about moving the town north, because during the winter they want to go hunting. And the way they do that is by driving on the sea ice.
Well, meanwhile, Dan Grossman, you're there speaking to researchers who are studying these fast-moving icebergs and have concern that the icebergs are displacing water in the oceans and endangering other places in the world.
Yeah, places like New Orleans, places like Bangladesh, which is very low-lying, a very large area with a lot of people. It's very low-lying. New Orleans, most of Florida is fairly close to sea level.
And yet, we understand it is one of the most beautiful places. Putting those concerns aside, what is it like to be out there on the ice sheet?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I didn't really imagine exactly what it would look like. I just thought it would be one vast plain, white plain. And to some extent, that's true. But it actually has hills and valleys. And so the ice, which is on top, is flowing over that topography, those hills and valleys. And so there's a gentle undulation that you see up here of the surface. And as you drive around on a day like today, it's a beautiful blue sky, and you can see these kind of dips and valleys. And the snow is not perfectly smooth. It's sculptured by the wind. The sunsets are amazing here. Just this week, we had the first day where the sun didn't set at all. And so the sun goes right down to the horizon, and then it appears to skim across the horizon for quite a while before it just begins to rise again and then goes around in the sky.
Hmm. I mean, it sounds so extraordinary. It's, you know, hard to imagine that it's also perhaps a bellwether of, you know, terrible climate change to come.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of indications now that something is really happening. There's been a lot of research in the last year that all seems to be pointing in the same direction, that there may be a faster movement of ice out of the center of this giant block of ice toward the ocean. So the evidence of that is growing.
Dan Grossman, a freelance environmental journalist, speaking to us from the ice sheet in Greenland, where scientists are studying the impact of glaciers melting on the environment everywhere in the world. Dan, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure talking to you, Robin.
And by the way, if you want to see pictures from Dan of Greenland, go to our website, here-now.org. Still to come, we go down to New Orleans for a little lesson in etouffee, mufalata, more. You're listening to Here and Now. Yes, we know. More people vote for American Idol than vote for president. Of course, we're way too sophisticated to be one of them. And besides, once they voted off that Chicken Little lookalike, who could watch? And then Elliot, the only true amateur in the whole bunch, he was robbed. And that Taylor Hicks, who does he think he is? Michael McDonald? And Catherine McPhee? Come on, she studied voice, cheater. With you, it's all changing in my destiny. Dream come true. Catherine McPhee and Taylor Hicks, the two American Idol finalists, sang their hearts out last night, after which millions of viewers voted by phone. And tonight, the results will be announced, a new American Idol crowned, and given a huge recording contract. Not that we follow this kind of thing. Apparently, Judge Simon Cowell practically anointed Taylor Hicks the winner.
Assuming that I was right, that the show was tied, have just won American Idol.
Bob Thompson is professor of popular culture at Syracuse University. He joins us now. And, Bob, I actually didn't watch last night, but do you think that because Simon Cowell told Taylor that he had it wrapped up, that people will agree with him and vote for Taylor, or because Simon likes Taylor, will they immediately all vote for Catherine?
Well, that's the thing. You never know how this is going to go. America likes underdogs. If they think that Taylor is going to be the winner, which everybody seems to think now, Simon included, it might motivate all those other people who don't want him to win to vote 50, 60, 70 more times once the episode's over. So you just never can tell with these things. And that's, what I suppose, what makes it exciting. It's not writers determining the outcome. It's a mystery until they count the votes.
Is that what it is? I mean, we're trying to get at why this show is so hugely popular. And is it because people feel they have some control over it?
Well, I think that's part of it. Certainly the ability to vote. And by the way, I don't think it's 50 million people voting. I think it's about 50 people voting a million times apiece, more like it. But part of it is the whole interactive idea, which gives you a sense not only that you're part of it, but also that it really keeps it a mystery as to how it's going to happen. But I think the big thing is that even though this happens to be about singing, it is one of the great soap operas going, and it guarantees every week that it's going to kill off a major character. There is very few other series that will do that. Other reality shows do, but there's that automatic payoff. And the other thing is that unlike Survivor or The Apprentice, where, you know, the winner really kind of becomes a trivia question within a couple of months, with American Idol, there really is something at stake as we watch this Horatio Alger rags-to-riches story, because the winner generally really becomes a star. Kelly Clarkson, of course, has got Grammy Awards already. All four of the winners have at least done something, and sometimes even in second place. So there really seems to be, this isn't only a soap opera, but there's really something at stake. Most importantly, though, I think it's that it's totally family-friendly. Everybody can watch it.
We were thinking that Carrie Underwood won Best New Artist at the Country Music Awards just last night. And, you say, though, that someone is voted off every week. Do you think, there was a time when there was a sense that it was a real amateur contest, but is it just me, or does this time around it feels as if the two finalists are kind of polished? I mean, Taylor has his own band already.
Yeah, they are, and for the last couple of times, we've seen a lot of people who have had an awful lot of experience going into this. And I guess that's what the show's about. It's not an amateur hour. We had those back in the 30s, very high ratings, by the way, which also discovered some people like, Frank Sinatra, Beverly Sills, some pretty big names. This isn't so much an amateur hour as an opportunity for people who have not yet been discovered to be discovered, and I think maybe not making it be people who have never performed for pay before might have been a good idea, because we see that with a lot of amateurs, you can get some pretty bad performances.
I still liked Elliot a lot, though.
Yeah, a lot of people quit watching when he... And I agree with you on that Chicken Little thing. I was pulling for that guy.
Yeah, but not that I watched, Bob.
Yeah, exactly.
Bob Thompson, popular culture critic at Syracuse University. And by the way, our sound from the American Idol program is courtesy of Fox Television, which apparently rules the airwaves now in the evenings because of this program. Bob, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Orleans is still recovering from Hurricane Katrina. Part of that recovery, restaurants are opening, kitchens are being restored, food is being cooked. Food critic Tom Fitzmaurice is deeply involved with that process. Born in the city on Mardi Gras, he's been writing about New Orleans and New Orleans food for 30 years, and for the past 18, he's hosted a daily 3-hour drive-time radio call-in show called The Food Show.
Do you know of any place that has decent fried chicken?
Yes, I do. It's Furies. They cook everything to order. So when you order the fried chicken, the waitress is going to tell you, you know, that's going to take 25 minutes.
Well, that's what it needs to take.
That's what it, absolutely, because they're going to go there, take raw chicken out of the refrigerator. They're going to season it up, bread it up. They're going to fry it to order. And as soon as it comes out of the fryer, it's going to come straight to the table. And it's going to be absolutely good.
Well, now Tom Fitzmaurice has a new cookbook. It's called New Orleans Food, more than 225 of the city's best recipes to cook at home. And he joins us from WWL, one of at least two radio stations in New Orleans that broadcast his show. Tom, 3 hours to talk about food. What do people talk about?
Oh, gosh, everything you can imagine. We talk about restaurants. We talk about recipes. We talk about buying food. Food is a real passion here. It's topic A. Well, it's actually topic B now since the hurricane.
Right. But, well, speaking of which, you know, how many restaurants are now back open after Hurricane Katrina?
639. Mm-hmm. That's out of 809 real restaurants. I'm not counting fast food or coffee houses or places like that. But we were down to zero for about 3 weeks.
Mm. Well, you say right out, straight out in the book that, you know, if it's not made in New Orleans, it sort of tastes different outside of New Orleans. But also in your book, you give people an opportunity to, for instance, overnight crawfish and stuff like that. So you give us great ways to access New Orleans food, but also to cook it. So let's talk about a little of that. You say your favorite cuisines are Creole and Cajun. Just refresh our memories. What are the differences?
Oh, we can't talk about that. That takes all day. In fact, I'm thinking of doing another book about nothing but that subject. I can only give you one dish that kind of catches it. If you get a jambalaya done Cajun style, it'll typically be done with sausage, meats, duck, chicken, and it'll be on the brown side and pretty spicy. A Creole jambalaya will have shrimp in it, usually some sausage, some bell pepper, and almost always tomato, which you would never really see in a Cajun jambalaya. But, you know, that's a very subtle thing, and that's not true of everything.
Huh. Well, and you also detail in your book other things that are maybe not unique to New Orleans, certainly, but would be called a major part of New Orleans cooking. Crawfish. You do point out, some people call them crayfish.
Yeah, you call them crayfish if you don't eat them.
These are these little sort of, they're like little lobsters. Baby lobsters?
Yeah, they're more like lobsters than like anything else, except for, you know, the claws not being quite as big as on a Maine lobster, but they do resemble them in other ways. In fact, we use as carnival throws plastic lobsters, and everybody says, whoa, look, crawfish.
Well, and you have something called a crawfish boil there. You say mounds of the red mud bugs. Now, I'm giving something away here. I obviously don't know much about this. Mud bugs, that's the crawfish?
Yeah, that's a nickname for crawfish,
because
they live in the mud.
And they're just piled on newspapers and people just eat them?
Oh, yeah. You just sit there and you peel them and you suck the heads and you squeeze the tips of the tails. I mean, that's the technique of eating them.
Yeah, okay.
Something you have to learn.
What's the best way to cook a crawfish?
There's a lot of different ways. You can make fancy dishes out of them. You can do this just very straightforward crawfish boil. You can make them into a great stew called crawfish etouffee. That's a really popular dish.
By the way, you say etouffee. What exactly does that mean?
Smothered. It's not exactly a stew. It's kind of a quick stew where it's steaming in its own juices.
It also sounds like it could be, you know, a put-down. Hey, touffee.
Well, yeah.
Some of the other recipes, what people think of when they think of New Orleans is po' boys. Muffalettas?
Muffalata.
Muffalata.
We eat those all the time. It's an old Sicilian dialect word for the loaf of bread that is used to make that. It goes back a bit over 100 years when the first Italian immigrants came to New Orleans. Every time I write about it for national consumption, I always get a call from the editor asking me how to spell it because they can't find it in any dictionaries.
Well, and I should ask you how to say it.
Yeah, muffalata.
Muffalata.
Muffalata. People say it two different ways.
Okay. There's gratin of crab boil. We discussed the crab boil. Redfish herb saint?
Yeah, that's a good dish. We love that herb saint flavor, which is an anise liqueur. Herb saint was the substitute for absinthe when that was outlawed.
Yeah, so you can die from drinking too much of that.
You know, there was a big campaign about that a long time ago, and it turns out, I mean, in recent research, it seems that none of the ingredients that were of concern back then, this is over 100 years ago now, actually ever made it into the absinthe to begin with. And the main problem a lot of people had with it, it seems, was that it was a popular kind of alcohol and people were drinking too much.
Yeah. And speaking of drinking, that could be why in one portion of your book you note that dying of cirrhosis of the liver in New Orleans is considered dying of natural causes.
Yeah, yeah, that's been said for years. This is a party town.
We don't want to make fun of
that. No, of
that,
course
but
not.
There is a lot of cooking with liquor as well.
Yes, oh yeah, all the time.
You're right, we cook with oceans of heavy cream, boulders of butter, herds of smoked pork. But has that changed over the last, you know, several decades?
No, if anything, it's getting worse or better, depending on how you look at it. This cookbook is not a light cookbook. There were too many of those coming out anyway. This is really the way we cook down here. If you come to the restaurants, that's what you're going to find.
What I love about the book is that you point people to how they can do some of this cooking, because obviously, well, you know, we're not going to be able to get an alligator for our alligator Creole.
You can order it by mail now. You can order anything by mail.
Oh, the poor alligators. Really? You can order alligator meat,
oh,
are you
sure.
saying?
You don't have to worry about the alligators. There's plenty of them here. They're always turning up at people's swimming pools.
We're talking to Tom Fitzmaurice. He's a popular radio host in New Orleans. He's also been a food critic, restaurant critic, and now he's got a book out, New Orleans Food, more than 225 of the city's best recipes to cook at home. And a portion of the proceeds from the book are going to benefit Habitat for Humanity. And I'm just wondering, you know, obviously it's a labor of love. It's a celebration. Is it a bit of a eulogy? You know, there's so much devastation. Even when the city comes back, is it going to come back, and is the food going to come back in full flower?
It's already there. There are two misconceptions about New Orleans right now. Some people think that this is still a pestilential hellhole where you're going to leave with some awful disease if you come here. And there are a lot of people who think that everything's back to normal. And neither one of those is true. We have about 65% of the city is still uninhabitable. But the places that you would come here for, the French Quarter, the Uptown section, most of the restaurants, it's all still there. You know, you don't come here to make money, that's for sure. You come here for the lifestyle, and a huge part of that is the food, and we've got it. It's there.
You ask a question in the book, which I'm going to paraphrase, but I'm going to find it here. You talk about some of the new restaurants, new cooks that are coming into the area, and you say that there's a question that you've asked yourself. Do we really need another new version of gumbo, bread pudding, or oysters Rockefeller with all the hundreds of recipes for those dishes already out there? Well, sort of paraphrasing the question back to you, do we really need another New Orleans cookbook?
I thought so, and here's what made me think so. There was a great cookbook that came out about 30 years ago, and it's still out. It's very good. It's called The New Orleans Cookbook by Richard and Rima Collin. And I use it often enough that I'm constantly finding myself saying, we really don't do that so much anymore, or there's a lot of dishes that have come along the way that are not in this book. And so I did think it was time to update it and show how New Orleans cuisine was in the year 2005.
Tom Fitzmaurice's book is called New Orleans Food. It's got more
than... that. What a title, huh?
It worked long
Pretty
and hard
original.
On that one.
Nobody's ever used it before.
More than 225 of the city's best recipes to cook at home. And again, remember, part of the proceeds go to Habitat for Humanity. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, Tom Fitzmaurice also suggests if you have questions about his recipes, contact him through his website or call his show. Everyone else does. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about henna, henna, henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anane. Giacomo Finane.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Aiko, aiko, ande. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Giacomo Finane.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.